John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Yeah, Bruce MacArthur was a 58-year-old male who killed and dismembered and buried in planters eight men from Toronto's Gay Village. And his first victim he killed in 2010. And we conducted several phases of investigative work. And ultimately, in January of 2018, we arrested him. And on the day that we arrested him, he was about to kill his ninth victim. So our intervention certainly saved that ninth victim. And the day we arrested him, we didn't know where any of these victims' remains were. And we could only link them to two of the disappearances of the eight. So it was a little bit dicey and a little bit stressful for about 96 hours until we started finding the remains.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA Special Agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. Hey, gang. Welcome back to this week's edition of Game of Crimes with Murphy in the Morning. You hear that every week, don't you? Well, that's because you guys keep me going. So thank you for continuing to come back to the show every week. Couldn't do any of this without you. Another fantastic guest this week, a 34-year veteran of the Toronto Police Service, served, just retired in January of 2024, so not that long ago. This gentleman was assigned eventually to the Homicide and Missing Persons Unit for 19 years. He went from a detective to a detective sergeant to the inspector in charge his last 5 years, in charge of all the Homicide and Missing Persons Unit in Toronto. And we're not talking about a small town where Murph grew up with 10,000, 9,000 people, whatever it was. We're talking about a major Canadian city. This guy, because of the things he did in his career, was recognized by the Toronto Life magazine as one of Toronto's 50 most influential people. And once wasn't enough. He did it twice. Oh, my goodness. He's also an adjunct professor at Umber College there in Toronto. He's appeared on a couple of TV series, notably for The Detective and Making a Serial Killer. And, yes, I did look up his IMDb page on the internet. He is a commentator on police and crime issues for media outlets throughout Toronto. He is now the author of a number one bestseller, and we're recording this on May 1st. His book just came out a few days ago, and it's already a number one bestseller. We're going to talk a lot about that towards the end. The name of his book is The High Road, Confessions of a Homicide Cop. It was released on April 28th. And I just got to say, Hank, and make sure I get this last name right, it's Singa. Did I get that right?
You got it as close as you can get it in North America. I won't confuse you with the Dutch pronunciation of it.
Well, Hank, welcome very much. I mean, I'm so honored to have you here on the Game of Crimes. Welcome, sir.
Thanks very much, Steve. And I know we chatted quite a while ago on social media, and I said, you've got to wait till my book comes out. And I'm glad it finally did. And as soon as I got that publishing date, I reached back out to you because I definitely am flattered and honored to be on your show here. And I've been looking forward to it for a very long time.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, you've got such a renowned career. It's unbelievable. The things that you had to put up with, the things that you were able to accomplish, and I'm getting way ahead of myself here, everybody, but this man exhibited true leadership within a law enforcement agency. And that's not the norm. We had a little discussion before we started recording here about some people get that title and they think they're all that in a bag of chips. And that's usually not the case. So just want to give a shout out to Steve Metelsky, who you've seen here on the podcast, two different episodes, episode 21 and episode 155. Steve made this introduction for me, gosh, I think over 2 years ago. And when I like to try and vet people, and when your name came up, he's like, this is the man. This is the man. So just I quit fangirling over here a little bit. If you would, Hank, just tell us, first of all, tell us how you say your last name in Dutch.
Well, in English, if you pronounce the D as a T, you get it close enough. It's Inga. But the Dutch really make that G into a bit of a guttural sound. So it's Inga. That's as close as I can get to it in Dutch. And my father would probably laugh at me and say, yeah, you almost got it. But it's like Vincent van Gogh. Everyone calls him Vincent van Gogh, but if you're in Holland, it's Vincent van Gogh. It's a little bit of a different pronunciation, but it's Inga, pretty common name in the province of Friesland in Holland, but not so common over here.
Yeah. Well, then that's why we're going to call you Hank today, if that's okay.
It's, yeah, I was the only Hank on the Toronto Police Service for many years, so that works. And if you ever said, I'm this police officer in Toronto named Hank, yeah, everybody would know. So
Yeah, it seems like you have a very renowned reputation up there. I've done quite a bit of research on you. But if you would, Hank, just tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what mom and dad did. Did you play sports in school? Did you go to college? That kind of thing, please.
Yeah, I was born in Hamilton, Ontario, back in 1967, and spent the first 4 or 5 years of my life in Hamilton, which was quite famous for being an industrial steel town. And my father worked in real estate. He had come to Canada with his family from Holland in the 1950s. My mother came in the 1960s, and they married and had 3 kids. I'm the youngest of 3. And when I was about 5, we moved to a suburb. It used to be a suburb of Hamilton, but since the population explosion, it's more considered now a suburb of Toronto, Burlington, Ontario. So I definitely spent my formative years in Burlington, Ontario. And as I tell people, I was born in Hamilton. I was raised in Burlington, and I grew up on the streets of Toronto. I joined the police force in 1989. Before then, I spent 2 years at college studying law enforcement, and then joined the Toronto Police Service in 1989, October 24th, 1989. And I retired from there January of 2024, although I walked out in September of 2023 from police headquarters, used up some vacation time and burned up that sick bank as well, and then formally retired in January of 2024.
There was, and I want to get into your career here a little bit, and first of all, I want to ask you, why law enforcement? Why did you choose law enforcement? And second of all, and this might become a little later, but why homicide? Because I know there was an event in your family's history that led to this, I believe.
Yeah. So my mother was born in 1934 in a little town called Heiligenhaus in southwestern Germany. And she was the youngest of 3 children, born to Arthur and Maria Jacobs. And Arthur Jacobs was a German Jew who was a Iron Cross winning veteran of World War I. And his wife, Maria, was a German Catholic. And they married in 1931 and had 3 kids. And ultimately, he was arrested by the Gestapo when the Nazi regime came into place, and placed into the concentration camp system in 1938. And never to see his family again, he was murdered on January 26th of 1942 in the gas chambers. My grandmother, with the 3 kids, they lost everything. They lost their house. They ended up living in a spare bedroom in an apartment belonging to another Jewish couple in Heiligenhaus. And then the rather infamous Kristallnacht happened in November of 1938, the Night of Broken Glass, as it's more commonly known as. And that Jewish couple that were putting my grandmother and the kids up, they were murdered that night. And so my grandmother would literally wake the kids up before the sun came up, take them into a nearby forest to the town. They'd spend the day in the forest and then come back once it got dark again. And that was through the winter of 1938, 1939. And eventually in 1939, my grandmother took her three kids, brought them to the train station in Dusseldorf, and put them on trains where they were taken to Holland and placed in Catholic orphanages. So my mother would have been about 4 years old at the time. Estranged from her father already, and I was estranged from her mother. And growing up as a half-Jewish 4-year-old in a Catholic orphanage, abused by the nuns for being half Jewish and abused by the other kids for being German, growing up in Holland during the war. So about as horrendous as of a childhood as you can imagine. And she made her way to England, trained as a nurse, came to Canada in the early 1960s. And like I said, met my father in Hamilton, and they got married in 1961, and the three of us were born. Recognizing the trauma that she suffered in her childhood, really by the time I was 10 or 11 years old, I was reading a piece in Time magazine about Simon Wiesenthal's hunt for Joseph Mengele in 1978. And I remarked to my mom that when I got older, that's what I wanted to do. And she said to me, well, by the time you're old enough, all the Nazis will probably be dead. And sadly, in 2026, she was prophetically wrong on that. But I started to look towards getting into a career where I could catch the bad guys and do the right thing. And I was working at a gas station when I was 16 years old, just part-time. And there was an incident there where a police officer in a patrol car arrived and very smartly snapped on his forage cap as he got out of his car and really de-escalated a volatile situation there. And I talk about that in the book. And I was like, okay, that's where I need to go right there. And so, I went to college for law and security and joined the police service in 1989. And then in 1991, as a young uniform officer, I found myself at a pretty brutal homicide scene in downtown Toronto. And I was standing, keeping security at the front door of this residence where this murder had occurred. It was a case, biker gang members, and the victim had been decapitated almost with an axe. His head was hanging on by a piece of skin at the back of his neck. So, and again, it's chaos, much like that gas station incident, as you can imagine. And the detective sergeant from the homicide squad, a fellow named Mike Hamill, he arrived a couple hours later with his team and just took control, calmed everything down, and just did a fantastic job and ultimately solved that murder and put somebody away for life for that murder. But I was just so impressed by seeing him and what he did. And it was very fortunate for me because, as you know, in policing, you can go a million different directions right with your career. And I saw that and I said, okay, I want to do that. And it took me 15 years, but in February of 2005, I was fortunate enough to be recognized for some of my investigative work, and I was brought onto the homicide squad as a detective, and I never left. I spent 18 years in homicide, first as a detective, and then the next level up here in Canada is detective sergeant, and I was promoted to detective sergeant about 6 years after I arrived there, and I spent a good time as a detective sergeant. And then ultimately in 2018, I was asked to become an acting inspector and actually run the unit, which is the largest homicide squad in Canada, quite a responsibility. So I ended up doing that and then was formally promoted in January of 2019 to inspector. So I did that for 5 years. And I never wanted to leave. I had a couple of offers of some courses or some positions that would give me further promotion, but I was like, no, this is where I've needed to be since I was a kid, right? And I don't want to leave it, and I didn't leave it until I retired.
So how big is the Toronto Police Service? How many employees, and then how many sworn officers do you have? I know it's a ton.
Well, it's fallen to levels as low as 4,600 sworn officers. And they're really trying to build that up to their first target was to get it back up to established numbers of 5,600. And now with, the street level crime and disorder that we're seeing on the streets, they're really aiming for 6,000 sworn officers, in addition to 2,000 to 3,000 civilian employees as well. So it's definitely a large service. I think per capita, it's a little bit lower than what we'd like to see. And the homicide squad itself encompasses not only the investigative response teams, but also encompasses a cold case unit, a missing persons unit. And we are mandated up here in the province of Ontario to use a software system, a case management system called PowerCase. And it's very cumbersome and labor intensive. So we actually have a specific section of the homicide squad, mostly civilian, who are basically file managers who make sure we abide by all the regulations and get our investigations and occurrences inputted into PowerCase. So, like I said, just over about 100 people. We also have a video analysis unit. I shouldn't forget them, which is something that I instituted back in 2018, 2019, with the advent of video surveillance. I had a case where video... and this is back in 2010. It's the Mark Moore case, if you've read the book, where video was so important, and yet we were still relying on VHS tapes to put our narratives together. And I had to go to the provincial police force to get someone who is qualified enough in video analysis to take that video footage and put it into a really good workable narrative. So when I was offered some funds in 2018 to enhance the homicide squad, I said, yeah, we need a video analysis unit so we don't have to outsource that type of work. And we brought some folks in and got them the equipment and got them properly trained. And they're doing some fantastic work today. As you can imagine, their mandate and their work onus has certainly just grown and grown and grown over the years.
There's a very well-known case that you worked up there, and I want to touch on that. I've got a ton of questions for you, but this is the one that seems to be, I guess, the most well-known is a way to say it, because it involved, I think, it was a serial murder case, 8 different victims, and your client was Bruce MacArthur. Can you just give us a condensed version of that case and what happened?
Yeah, Bruce MacArthur was a 58-year-old male who killed and dismembered and buried in planters 8 men from Toronto's Gay Village. And his first victim he killed in 2010. And we conducted several phases of investigative work. And ultimately, in January of 2018, we arrested him. And on the day that we arrested him, he was about to kill his 9th victim. So our intervention certainly saved that 9th victim. And the day we arrested him, we didn't know where any of these victims' remains were. And we could only link them to 2 of the disappearances of the 8. So it was a little bit dicey and a little bit stressful for about 96 hours until we started finding the remains. But ultimately, as we recovered victims and identified them from these planters and also from a ravine at the back of an address that he had access to, we charged him with those 8 counts of first-degree murder, and there was no trial. He pled guilty in January of 2019 and is serving life in prison right now, and I can't imagine he'll ever get out, because he's a little bit older and he's not the healthiest individual. So I think he would be eligible for parole when he's about 90 years old.
You know, and that's one of the issues I have with our system, our judicial system here in the United States, is he pled guilty to killing 8 innocent people, regardless of their sexual orientation or their background or their ethnicity, whatever it is. He should never, in Murph's opinion, have an opportunity at parole. He is right where he's supposed to be, and that's locked away from everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a real big flaw in our parole systems is, okay, he's, like you said, he's killed eight innocent victims. Why should their families or loved ones ever be subjected to a parole hearing? And we lose sight of that because we've had some younger serial killers up here in Canada, most notably a fellow named Paul Bernardo. And he killed some young women. He essentially grabbed them off the street, held them captive for days on end, sexually assaulted them, killed them, and he was caught. And same thing, sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole for 25 years. Well, guess what? Those 25 years are up. So every 2 years, the families of these young girls have to go back to the parole board and provide their victim statements and plead with the parole board not to release him. And I don't think he'll ever get released, but why should they have to keep doing that? It just re-victimizes them over and over again. So a lot of issues, I think, with that particular system, with our correction systems and some of our sentencing guidelines as well.
Mm-hmm. Were there any major mistakes? Like you said, it took 96 hours before you started to find the bodies. Did he tell you where they were? How'd you find them?
He didn't tell us where they were. So he did a lot of, he was self-employed as a landscaper. And we had surveillance on him for several months. And we identified several addresses that we could associate him to, including an address about an hour north of Toronto in the middle of nowhere. Some farmland, and we thought, oh, for sure our victims are going to be up there, and let's get them into custody and let's get our warrants into place, and that's got to be the place where he's getting rid of the victims. But we had seen him always attend an address just on the east side of downtown, where he stored his landscaping equipment in the garage, and in exchange, he took care of the landscaping for this elderly couple that lived there. And so naturally, that was one of the addresses we searched. And it was the dead of winter, January of 2018. It was brutally cold out here. And I'll talk in Celsius. It was about minus 25 degrees Celsius during the day. Don't even ask me what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's cold. It's one of those days where, you know, my threshold for outdoor activities during the winter is about minus 15. Any colder than that, forget it. I'm not even going outside. And like I said, we were pretty steady at about minus 25. So we seized this address and we sent our K-9 unit to sniff around, and our K-9 indicated on a planter. But we didn't know if they were indicating on the planter or the ground below the planter. So what we did is we took the planters from the backyard and we brought them to our property bureau, which is just this massive, massive warehouse in North Toronto. And we stored them there while we covered the backyard with a military tent and started trying to thaw the ground because we figured we'd be digging in the ground there. And within about 24 hours of bringing those planters up to the property bureau, the manager there called us and said, get these out of here because they're stinking up the entire warehouse. And
that's a clue.
That's a clue. So, and this warehouse, as you can imagine, and I always throw this at my students, you'll appreciate this. And I said, to give you an idea of how big this warehouse is, I always say, do you remember the closing scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark? And I guarantee you, you do. And my students in the early 20s, maybe 10% of them like know what I'm talking about. So yeah. I always make a point when I'm teaching. I'm like, okay, class assignment. You have to watch Raiders of the Lost Ark before the end of term. And there might be a bonus question on the exam on that movie. So nobody ever gets it right. I think I've had one person get it right, but I digress. So we took those planters from the warehouse and we brought them to the morgue. Where the pathologists and the anthropologists work, and they had to thaw out for a couple more days. And it got to the point where they could put them into the x-ray machines, and they x-rayed them, and they called us, and they said, okay, looks like there's something in those planters. And I went up, and I still remember looking at that x-ray. You could pretty clearly see the outline of a rib cage. So seven of our eight victims, their remains were encased in these planters, and we recovered all of them. But the last victim was put into a large plastic or rubber garbage container, just like a regular garbage pail. And there is a ravine back at the back of that address. And Mr. MacArthur had buried that garbage pail in that ravine. So we didn't recover that till July. We had to wait for the winter to be over, for the ground to thaw. We didn't know where this particular victim was. Again, we sent the canine units into the backyard in the ravine, and they were indicating on this particular area, but it belonged to the Conservation Authority. And also there was a rail line at the bottom of the ravine, so we had the railway company involved. And once we got clearance and authorization from everyone, we went down there and did some digging, and we found the eighth and final victim in that garbage pail. So long investigation, and obviously got a lot of attention, not just in Canada, but across the world, right? My cousins were sending me newspaper clippings from Holland about the case. So that was certainly the most famous case out of the ones I did, not the most complex case of the ones that I did, but definitely the most famous.
Yeah. And thank you for all that information. It's, holy cow, you just never know. But there was another cold case, because you were, your unit was in charge of cold case investigations, and we had a another homicide detective on here back in 2022. Stephen Smith was our guest here on the show, and he talked about the Christine Jessup case, which they employed forensic genealogy to identify her murderer. And rather than recap that investigation, when this was kind of the introduction of DNA as evidence to the Toronto Police Service, is that right? Is that fair to say?
Well, it was certainly the introduction of genetic forensic genetic genealogy to the Toronto Police Service. DNA had been used in the past, but certainly taking that offender DNA profile that had been captured in, it would have been 1984, I believe, when Christine Jessup was killed. And it wasn't even in Toronto, as you probably remember from speaking with Steve. But certainly that was the first case of taking that offender DNA profile and chasing it down through genetic genealogy and ancestry and identifying who the real killer was, because somebody else had been arrested and charged and convicted of the murder, and then ultimately they were exonerated. But that question always remained, and it wasn't until we nailed it down with that DNA that we were able to say, yeah, he wasn't the real killer. Here's who the real killer was.
Jeez. You know, and we've talked about this here before on the Game of Crimes. Law enforcement around the world does not want to put the wrong person in jail, especially for a crime like murder. You know, and then here in our country, a lot of the states have the death penalty. We have the federal death penalty here. Yeah. So you certainly don't want to do that. Mistakes can be made, but I think that's why it takes so long to carry out an execution, also just in case new technology is developed that could either prove or disprove that the particular case.
Yeah, you never want to be accused of tunnel vision in the court system. And sometimes it's a desperation ploy by defense counsel to try and create the illusion of tunnel vision when in fact you didn't. But to legitimately have tunnel vision and put the wrong person in jail, I can't think of anything worse. I'm not so desperate to clear my murder cases. I'm not afraid to walk away from a murder case and say, I can't manufacture evidence here. It's just not there. And yes, it will remain unsolved, but maybe a couple of years down the road, that tip will come in or that piece of evidence will be found where I can lay the charge. But I'm certainly not going to focus on the wrong line of suspicion without that evidence to risk putting the wrong person into jail for the rest of their life.
Right. Right. I'm with you 100%. Yeah. So of all the years you spent in homicide, You got any a guesstimate of how many homicides that you and your unit were involved with?
Well, personally, you know what, and you've probably seen it down there, and I've certainly seen some American homicide investigators who retire and they say, I've investigated 400 homicides. And you look at the town that they're from and you're like, yeah, there's weren't even 400 homicides during the time frame down there, right? And so, and we get the same thing up here. We see guys who are trying to do a little bit of self-promotion, and good for them in some respects, but they'll say, I worked 200 homicides. And I can tell you, in the 13 years that I was involved as either a primary investigator, major case manager, or file manager, I was directly involved in 80 murder investigations. So if any Toronto homicide detective comes to you and says, I spent 5 years in homicide and I investigated 200 cases, they're full of it. So directly involved in 80, cleared 77% of those, or my team's cleared 77% of those 80 cases. But overall, in the city of Toronto, the highest number we had for murders was 2018, which was the first year I took over as unit commander. We had 98 murders. Sure. We had a low of, I believe it was 48 a few years before then. And as you've probably noticed, North America-wide, murder rates are way, way down. So I believe Toronto has only had 7 or 8 murders so far this year. But usually we would have about average of 70 a year. And the homicide squad, personnel-wise, was very well equipped to handle 70 if we were fully staffed. But that would keep you pretty busy dealing with those 70. So, and we saw clearance rates, much like you did in the United States, falling precipitously close to 50%, which nobody wants to see.
Right.
So I took over the homicide squad in 2018, and I made some changes in the homicide squad. And we can talk about those more in depth if you want. But ultimately, in 2022, our homicide squad cleared 86% of their cases. And when I retired in September of 2023, the homicide squad, I believe, was at 86% again. And it dipped a little bit, but they still finished the year at 82%. And the following year, 2024, 2025, again, over 80% for those subsequent years.
That's excellent. That is excellent. I'm telling the listeners that that's way above typically what we see here in the United States in the major cities.
Yeah, I literally got called from some of my friends in American cities in 2022, and they were like, what are you guys doing? All right. And like I said, we could probably do an entire episode on some of the subtle changes that were made and some of the enhancements that we made. But I really think we're also seeing across the continent the advent of video surveillance, where when I started an homicide, and I still remember the case, we captured a video on camera. It was in the back of a taxi cab. And it wasn't my team that was working on it. It was another team, but the whole office came in and just marveled at the fact that we caught this murder on camera, right? And how great is that? And it's going to be easy to solve. And it was solved. And you fast forward to 2026, if you don't capture a murder on camera, it's a bit of an anomaly, right? So that, I think that helps out tremendously with the clearance rates. And I think the more you clear homicides, you're putting the right bad guys in jail. And you're making everyone talks about proactive policing and acting before the crime. I say, yeah, but homicide in a way is proactive policing, because you put somebody like that in jail for the rest of their lives, they're not going to commit any more murders, right? And that's going to keep the streets safer. So it has a proactive aspect to it. And like I said, with the higher clearance rates, that certainly had an impact.
Yep. Yep. So, Hank, after explaining that, and thank you for those explanations, because it's my experience in homicide when I was uniform was just protecting the outside of the scene, maybe doing some peripheral things inside because it was a small police department. And luckily, if we had two homicides in a year, that was a bad year.
Wow.
Yeah. But based on your career, well, you've seen so much carnage and you can see how ruthless people can be to each other. How do you deal with that? Did you experience depression, anxiety, PTSD, those kind of things?
Yeah, you know what? And it's a great question. And I don't know if I've ever would have been clinically diagnosed with PTSD. There is absolutely a lot of trauma. And if you read the book, the one chapter I thought about not even including was the murder of a 7-year-old girl back in 2008. Yeah. And that was certainly one of the most traumatic investigations. And I've heard from some people and they're like, yeah, it's traumatizing to read. And I do many case presentations across the country. And that is the only case presentation I've done where people have had to get up and walk out, right? Because nobody wants to deal with the murder of a young child. Certainly nobody wants to investigate it. And even when discussing the book, very few people want to read about it. But I mean, the book is a memoir. Here's what I experienced. Here's what I went through. So absolutely traumatizing. There's that stat out there that your average human being in their lifetime will experience 4 to 6 traumatic events in their life, whereas first responders are likely to experience about 700 or 800. So trying to develop coping mechanisms for that amount of trauma becomes so, so important for first responders. And as tough as police officers have, I always say paramedics have it even worse, because absolutely every call they go to is trauma inducing, right? Corrections officers, we see some corrections officers who have a really, really hard time fitting back in with society. So having those coping mechanisms, having a strong family support, stay away from the crutches like alcohol and narcotics, have those outside hobbies, athletics was always my thing. And you've got to really, really develop a social circle that aren't police officers. And the amount of grounding and latitude that you get from that and having those conversations, it can be tough sometimes because I'll tell you, you're with a group of people, they all want to hear your police stories.
Right.
And so you find yourself talking about it anyway. And the novelty of that seems to wear off very quickly as well. So if that's the only thing that's attracted you to somebody else and suddenly they grow weary of it, you'll likely lose that friendship. So developing other hobbies and other interests outside of policing that you can use to socialize with other people. My thing right now is bike riding. I love road cycling. It's very social. I've developed a fantastic group of friends through that. And yes, sometimes I talk about police experiences. And certainly the first time I meet somebody through cycling, it's the first thing they want to talk about. But the interest is expanded beyond that because it goes from talking about police war stories to talking about the group set that you have on your bike and things like that, right? So you certainly don't want to have policing to be the only thing in your arsenal to socialize with.
So when you would go home, because I mean, working homicides, I've tried to explain to people here on the show before how this law enforcement's not a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job. It's a lifestyle, but homicide even more so, because I can't think of a more serious crime than murder. Yeah. So you could be days or possibly even weeks at a time where you, if you get home, you're there to take a shower, change clothes, take a nap, and head right back out.
Yeah.
Did you have some kind of mental trick or something that you used where you could turn that off when you came in so that you could talk to your family like a father and like a husband? Or how did you handle that?
If I was in the middle of a murder investigation, no, I couldn't turn it off. And like you said, I would literally come home, have a nap, wake up like that after an hour and a half, 2 hours, shower, put another suit on, and go right back in. And it wasn't until you, because with homicide work, you develop momentum in your investigation. And if you lose that momentum, it's really, really hard to get it back. So to say, we've gone for a tough stretch here for a couple of days, let's go home, take a 2-day break or even a 1-day break, and then everyone come back in. It's you just can't do that with a murder investigation. So we were very, very fortunate as time passed by, and we were able to, instead of when I first started homicide, it was there'd be two of us on a team responding to a murder. And as the years went by, they started realizing it's smarter to front end load an investigation with personnel. So we'd be rolling out with 6 or 7 people. And if you have that luxury, you know, you're 24, 36 hours into a murder investigation, everyone's tired, the brain stopped working, and you recognize, okay, you two go grab a nap for a couple hours, come back, your brain will be working again. You can keep an eye on everyone else. And when you come back, you two go take a break for a while. So I ran an investigation in late 2009. It was actually the killing of a prosecution witness for an attempted murder the year before. And we ran really, really hard for about 2.5 weeks straight. And literally going all day into the evening, going home, sleeping for a couple hours, coming back in, going again. And I talk about it in the book, and waking up on a highway at 5 o'clock in the morning with my car at a 45 degree angle across the highway, and getting home and grabbing a nap, and then the phone ringing, and a person on the other end saying, we've got your guy in custody up here in Ottawa. You've got to come up and get him again. And putting my suit on, and okay, I'm going to go back up to Ottawa again. And my wife saying, stop, right? You can't. Physically, you cannot. So sure enough, very smartly, made a phone call, got somebody else to go back up to Ottawa and pick this guy up. But if I didn't have that intervention from my wife at the time, I would have jumped right back in the car and gone, because I think you need that addiction, and I think you need that drive. You know, you've probably seen it down there. We certainly see it up here, where people come into homicide because they see it as an easy stepping stone to promotion, right? It used to be a given in the Toronto Police Service. You want to get promoted, you got to spend 2 or 3 years in homicide, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the knowledge and the skills that you develop, which sometimes you don't even appreciate you're developing, become innate in that homicide work. So a lot of guys would come in, they weren't really interested in doing homicide work, but they wanted that experience, and then they would leave. I don't want people like that. I want people who are addicted to it, who are driven by it, who take those hours and really put them to the best use, and are willing to do that drive after working for 24 hours, right? You know, fortunately, like I said, we can spell people off and not put anybody in any danger. But I've also seen people check out of homicide very, very quickly, right? They come to homicide about a month later. They're like, yeah, I can't do this. Okay, thanks for coming out. Appreciate it. Send you back to your home division, and that's it. I never wanted anybody in my homicide squad who didn't want to be there.
Absolutely.
Right. I'd rather run shorthanded than have people who weren't interested in doing the work. And I think that contributed to the reason why we were successful from 2022 onwards.
Yeah. Yeah. They're distracting, and then they take the focus off of what's really important.
Yeah. If they're there for their egos or anything else, yeah, no, thank you.
That's the wrong reason.
Don't want you here. Right.
Yeah. In your book, I was reading about where the prosecutor's offices are making plea deals on homicide cases. Was there a case, an outcome that still bothers you, not because it went unsolved, but because you feel like justice was not served in that investigation?
I don't think I ever had a plea deal that was worked out with prosecutors where they didn't seek my input. And we didn't come to an agreement. And usually, if you looked at the legal reasons and the prosecution's hurdles, it usually any one of them that I was involved in worked out for the better. The only case, and I write about it in the book, is where we had this fellow who we charged with second-degree murder for a shooting outside of a nightclub back in 2006. And we had a great case. It was on video, and video wasn't terrific back then, but the video system that this nightclub used was certainly ahead of its time back then. So we had the murder on video, and the suspect was shooting at a bouncer because the bouncer had had him in a headlock to try and break up a robbery. And so when he released him from the headlock, the suspect tried to shoot at the bouncer, missed, and killed an innocent victim who was coming out of the nightclub, and almost killed, it missed by millimeters, a second victim where the bullet lodged in his chest right beside his heart. So like I said, it was on video, and we had our suspect's DNA via the saliva on the chest area of the bouncer's jacket who had him in the headlock. So sounds like a slam dunk case. We had a trial, and we ended up with a hung jury, which was very frustrating. But then we had a second trial, and he was convicted. And he got a pretty good whack at sentencing of life in prison, but parole eligibility set at 18 years, which was very, very high for that type of offense, although I know it doesn't sound like much. Mm-hmm. And he appealed and won an appeal based on some of the judge's closing comments during that second trial. So he came back for a third trial. And we ran that third trial over several weeks in 2019. And the day before that case was going to go to the jury, the Supreme Court came down with a decision about how jury panels are selected. And since we didn't have that decision when we selected our jury panel, it now affected how our jury panel was selected. So the judge said, okay, mistrial, we've got to do it again. So you can imagine, okay, we've got to do a fourth trial now. Mm. And by this time, this fellow had served about 12 years. And so the Crown just said, listen, we'll take a plea to the lesser offense of manslaughter. He can walk out today. And so that's what we ended up with. So that one frustrates me, but it's certainly understandable why they took that plea rather than running a fourth trial. Because you can imagine, and the victim actually, his mother was from down in the States. And she came up for that first trial and sat through it and had the hung jury. So the second trial, she came up for a few days, but couldn't come up for too much of it. But obviously was very happy when he was convicted and sent to prison. Yeah, she didn't come back for the third trial, and she certainly wouldn't have come back for a fourth trial. And that's got to be hugely onerous on her and other family members to have to sit through something like that and just see this this mess that has become within the court system. So that's the one case where I say, yeah, the outcome really didn't fit where it should have.
And that's the exact case I was talking about, because the fact that they got the DNA from the saliva off of the bouncer's jacket because he had him in that headlock, but then to get a DNA sample from him, surveillance followed him until he spit on the street.
Yeah, he's we couldn't find him for months. I mean, the murder happened in the beginning of July of 2006, and he disappeared. He was pretty high-ranking gang member in the city, and he disappeared, and he didn't pop his head up again, and we kept it quiet. We didn't let anybody know that we were looking for him because we knew he would never come back. And so we kept it quiet. And I guess when he felt the heat was off, he came back to Toronto, and we followed him, and our surveillance team saw him spitting in a parking lot. And they grabbed that saliva and sure enough, made the match. So, which is interesting because it's called getting a discard DNA sample. And all the gang murders I had where I needed a discard DNA sample and had surveillance, they all got them in the parking lot of that mall. And so I always say, you don't want to go to that mall, right? A lot of bad guys at that mall. And Yeah, even I mean, the one guy, Mark Moore, that I talk about, that we convicted of four shooting murders here in Toronto in 2010. Guess where we arrested him? In the parking lot of that mall, right? So not a great mall to be going to.
There was, when I was a young DEA agent down in Miami back in the late 1980s, there was a mall that the traffickers like to use, and we like to go eat there, and a lot of deals were set up, but you didn't want to shop there because there were a lot of shootouts in that
mall. Yeah, same. Probably not as many shootouts as you'd get in Miami, but yeah, same sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And there's a very nice high-end furniture store at that mall, and my wife likes to go there, and I'm like, okay, but we're going into that furniture store, getting right back out again, right? So.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, all these years of investigating homicides, I think I know the answer to this, but I want to hear from an expert like yourself. Did you see any behavioral patterns that from killers that most people would never notice, any real telltale signs?
You know what? It's a fantastic question. And you're the second person this week to ask me the exact same question. And certainly with serial killers, and I've been involved in the investigation and successful prosecution of two of them, psychologists and psychiatrists will look at them and they'll say they're either psychopaths or they're sociopaths. And there's warning signs. But for your average killer on the streets in a big city, I don't think there's any indication of predictable behavior that you can assign to any individual one of them. I think a lot of the times it's a very bad, impulsive decision made at one particular point in time. Certainly gang members are going to be at higher risk of committing murders and also being murdered on the streets. But if you look at all the different types of murders, like the domestic murders, sometimes usually the man killing the wife, sometimes the wife killing the husband, a lot of them are just very poor decisions at one particular moment in time and very unpredictable. And that's the scary thing.
Yeah, because you think everybody's got a calm attitude or demeanor about themselves, but there are, I guess you'd call them the heat of passion crimes that result in murders.
We had a police officer years ago who killed his girlfriend, and I knew him quite well. And yeah, he was a little bit off the wall. Always was, but if he had said he's gonna kill his girlfriend, there was nothing that would say to me, yeah, okay, yeah, he's the type to do that, right? So I think it's very unpredictable.
Right. So here's a little interesting question. What do movies and even us podcasters, you know, even here in true crime, what is it that we traditionally or typically get wrong about homicide investigations?
Note taken. When have you ever seen, it drives me nuts. You know, you've watched The Wire, I'm sure. And, you know, I think The Wire gets it very, very right when it comes to some of the politics and policing and some of the desperation in the investigative process. When have you ever seen a homicide investigator in a movie or TV show pull up to a murder scene in their car and not get out of their car for an hour because they're writing notes? Because I was that homicide guy, and that's what homicide guys will do. And they'll get out of their car, and all the coppers will come running up to them wanting to tell them stuff. And you have to hold on a second, because everything you say to me, I'm writing down. And the number of hours that you sit at your desk in the police station or back at headquarters, just with your head down, writing. It wouldn't make for very good television or movies, but that's just such a huge part of the job, right? Is that.
Yep.
Right. And keeping a record of everything. So I really think the TV shows and movies, that's the number one thing that they miss.
I agree. And that's, you know, when I was a young supervisor coming up, I really got to be a bitch about the paperwork. I went to high school and college in West Virginia, which was fine. But I'm thinking, if this small town boy can write in chronological order, can spell correctly, can explain things out to where they're understandable, it doesn't have to be, you know, this your juries are not going to be all educated professors that'll sit there and dissect everything you say. And then on top of that, a defense attorney, the first introduction they typically have to you is in your reports.
Exactly. Exactly. And yeah, you read some of these police reports and you just shake your head and you think, did you go to high school? And I mean, when I started, we had the old manual typewriters, and you'd have to fight to get into the division in time to get the typewriter that had the least amount of missing keys on it. Right. So you and your fingers would be bleeding at the end of it from all those missing keys. And so you had to develop that skill, and you couldn't make a mistake on some of the legal documents. Otherwise, you'd have to take it out, tear it up, start again. So maybe it's a bit of a lost art now, and maybe AI will help with some of these occurrence reports. But certainly, if you give a defense lawyer that ammunition from the get-go with the very first pages that you're producing to them, you're going to have a tough time in court. It's not going to be fun. So I always took great pride in my reports and knowledge of the legal requirements before I'd put my synopsis together and submit that as disclosure. So same with your notes. And you and I could probably have a complete individual discussion on note-taking. You know, you talk about chronological, but I always talk about keeping your notes live as the information is coming into you, and that might not end up as being chronological, right? But if you have to then take that work product and create a legible synopsis of it for submission to court, that's where it should be chronological and well written as well.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they probably called me the paperwork Nazi back then. And I even came up with my, because a lot of reports are repetitive. And I would came up with my own example where we call them go-bys. So if you use my go-bys, there's a real good chance it's going to pass right on through me, as long as it's the words are spelled correctly and things like that.
Yeah.
And people would complain and fuss about it. And I had one female agent who'd been on the job, DEA. I was probably on the job maybe 12 years at that point, but I'd been a cop for 12 years before DEA. And she'd been on with DEA 23 years, I think it was. And she challenged me. She says, I've been writing like this for 23 years. I'm like, just doing it for 23 years doesn't make it right. It's still wrong. Yeah. And she hung in there with me. She turned out being a good investigator.
Amazing. Yeah. And I had the same thing. And I mentioned in the book, like I thought I was pretty good at writing search warrants and judicial authorizations. And I kept them chronological and almost reading like a book. And then I get to homicide, and my partner, who is fantastic writer, one says, yeah, no, you can't do it that way. And here's the way you have to do it. And make it read like that legal document right off the bat. And so my paperwork, my warrant writing certainly evolved and was a work in progress probably till the day I retired. But I think it was always at a pretty high standard and a high level. I've seen some terrible paperwork. And even in retirement, with some of the things I'm involved in, and I see police reports, and it makes you shake your head, right?
Yep. I'm shaking my head right now. I guess from experience. But well, we've been going about an hour now, Hank, and everybody. Hank has agreed to come back for tomorrow's part two episode. So we're going to call it a day for today. His book just came out a few days ago. He's doing multiple interviews, and he's gracious enough to give us his time today. So thank you, folks, for continuing to come and support the Game of Crimes. Come back tomorrow, because I still got two pages of questions here. We're not going to have enough time to cover everything, but we'll get through as much as we can. So God bless. Take care of yourself. We'll see y'all tomorrow.
Moro Casino.
America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.